Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 1, Chapter 3. Krishna is the source of all incarnations, text 34. Yadi Esha Uparata Devi Maya Vaisharadi Mati Sampana Eva Iti Vidu Mahimni Sve Mahiyate Yadyesho Parata Devi Maya Vaisharadi Mati Sampana Evati Vidur Mahimni Sve Mahiyate Yadyesho Parata Devi Maya Vaisharadi Mati Sampana Evati Vidur Mahimni Sve Mahiyate. Yidi, if, however, Esha, they, Uparata, subsided. Devi Maya, illusory energy. Vaisharadi, full of knowledge. Mati, enlightenment. Sampana, enriched with. Eva, certainly. Iti, thus. Vidu, being cognizant of. Mahimni, in the glories. Sway of the self. Mahiyate, being situated in. Translation purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. If the original illusory energy, if the illusory energy subsides and the living entity becomes fully enriched with knowledge by the grace of the Lord, then he becomes at once enlightened with self-realization and thus becomes situated in his own glory. Purport. Because the Lord is the absolute transcendence, all of his forms, names, pastimes, attributes, associates, and energies are identical with him. His transcendental energy acts according to his omnipotency. The same energy acts as his external, internal, and marginal energies. And by his omnipotency, he can perform anything and everything through the agency of any of the above energies. He can turn external energy into internal by his will. Therefore, by his grace, the external energy, which is employed in illusoring those living beings who want to have it, subsides by the will of the Lord in terms of repentance and penance for the conditioned soul. And the very same energy then acts to help the purified living being make progress on the path of self-realization. The example of the electrical energy is very appropriate in this connection. The expert electrician can utilize the electrical energy for both heating and cooling by adjustment only. Similarly, the external energy which now bewilders the living being into continuation of birth and death is turned into internal potency by the will of the Lord to lead the living being to eternal life. When the living being is thus graced by the Lord, he is placed in his proper constitutional position to enjoy eternal spiritual life. Om Vishnu Vidyaya Krishna Prasthai Bhutai Srimate Bhakti Vidanta Swami Tanamane Namaste Sarasatun Deve Gauravani Vicharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paskatya De Sitarne Patasya Karyam karyanam kavidite etat samastya pyarikas chudrishite parashya shaktir vividaiva shruyute swabhavaki jnana bala kriyacha. It is said in the Vedic literature, etasya karyam karanam chavidite. It is understood that the Supreme Lord has nothing to do. Here in the material world, we're constantly doing something, or we have to do things. Because as soon as we get a material body and a material mind, there are so many demands. Therefore, we have so many activities to perform in order to fulfill these demands. But it is said that the Supreme Lord, he has nothing to do in the material world in the sense that he has no obligation. It's not that he's forced to come to the material world, or that while he's in the material world, he's obliged to do so many activities. Because it is never seen, or also it has never been found, that anyone is equal to Krishna. It is very hard for us to imagine what Krishna is like. It is said that he is full of all opulences, such as Aishvaryasya Samagrasya Viryasya Yashasya Sriyaha Jnana Vairagyas Chaiva Shana Bhage Hitinganaha. First of all, he owns everything. So this is very hard to conceive of, to consider that someone actually is controlling everything. Because to own something, you actually have to be in control of it. If you think you own something but you're not controlling it, then what is the question of owning something? So Krishna is controlling everything. So that's very difficult for us to figure out, how there can be someone who's controlling both the atoms, down to the minute atom, up to the whole universe. So naturally the mind says it's not possible. No one can be doing it. It couldn't exist. Because the conditioned soul, he wants to judge everything according to his own experience. Although his experience is quite limited, still he thinks more or less the criteria of reality is his experience. And if something doesn't fit into his experience, then it doesn't fit into reality. Therefore, in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna teaches us that we are not this body. So it is not that at a certain point of understanding, then we should think, this is a waste of time hearing I'm not this body. I heard that a million times. Hearing, of course, a million times is one thing, but if we actually realize that we are not this body, then all our problems would be solved. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna first of all tells Arjuna, Deino smita dehe komaram yovanam jara tadahantara praptir diryas tatra namuyati, that the body is changing. Such a simple thing, everyone can see that their body is changing. But the self, who is conscious of the body, who experiences the changing of the body, that person is always the same. No sane person will think, no, that's not true. I'm always changing. I'm a different person at every moment. Because if we were a different person at every moment, how would we remember that we were a different person at every moment? It wouldn't be possible. The next person, just like I was reading one book, it was a devotee book, but I can't figure out why he wrote about it. But he was talking about multiple personalities. He was saying that there was one person, Dr. Deepak Chopra, and he was on the internet, the health conference. He translated from Swedish into English one of Deepak Chopra's books. I don't know why he just didn't buy the book in English. That wasn't translated before. But in the book it mentions one boy, he had 10 personalities within him. Couldn't make up his mind. He had 10 personalities, And each personality is completely different from the next. And when he would be one personality, say Tim, and when Tim would eat, say, peanut butter, he'd become allergic. He was allergic to peanut butter, and he'd break out in hives. But as soon as Bob, his other personality, took over, then immediately the hives would go away, even if he was in the midst of digesting the peanut butter. So he had all, every personality had a completely different disease or diseases, set of personality and likes and dislikes and what he could eat and what he couldn't eat and all different symptoms. So when he would become John, all kinds of warts would immediately break out. And when he'd become Tim, then he'd be allergic to peanut butter. He had complete symptoms. But he was always the same person, although he thought he had many different personalities. So the point is that the body's changing. It may go, we may go through so many different states of experience. Just like our mentality, our personality, our physical appearance is completely different when we were 5 years old. And now it's different. And in, as we can see in modern society, when someone's 80 years old, they come back and they have their same personality they had when they were 5 years old. That's normal. That's the people in general. Not everyone. Devotees, hopefully, we won't have to go through that. But in any case, it's still the same person because we are just like watching a movie. But we're so much absorbed in experiencing this movie that we actually think that we're the movie. We think that we're this machine, we're saying so many things, we're doing so many things, but factually we're simply the observer and the experiencer of what's going through this body, mind, and even the conceptions of life that we have. But we're not the body. So it is, one who can meditate on this, one can understand things are not quite as I think they are, and my present material understanding of things. Even the simple thing that I'm not my body, which a reasonable person is able to understand by dint of his intelligence, that actually I'm aloof from this body, I have nothing to do with the body, but the body somehow or another is going on, and it's not going on exactly, directly, by my moving it, although I do have something to do with it. It's going on by my desire through some other agency. The illusion of the living entity in the material world is he thinks that he's directly doing everything. So Krishna says, Nakartrivam Nakarmani, Lokasya Srijati Prabho, Nakarma, Palasam Yogam, Svabhavas Tu Pravartate. So this is a subtle point that the living entity, he doesn't do anything in the sense that he's not directly doing anything. Sarva Karmani Manasa, Sanyasyaste Sukham Sukhi, Naiva Dware Pare Dehi, Naiva Kuravan Nakaryan. That the embodied soul, the master of the city of his body. So Krishna says two different things. He's the master of the city of the body. Sarva Karmani Manasa, Sanyasyaste Sukham Sukhi. When he realizes that he's not doing anything, then he lives happily in the city of the nine gates, the material body, neither working nor causing work to be done. So we're actually the master of the city of this body in the sense that according to how we desire, the material world has been arranged through Krishna's agency, material energy, in such a way that there is a relationship between what we're desiring and what we're doing, what this body is doing. That simply by the desire of the soul, the body is going on. Although the soul is not changing, although the soul isn't directly doing anything, but there's a relationship between his desires and what the body's doing, what we're thinking, what we're feeling, what we're understanding. There's a relationship between them. But the problem is that the soul, he thinks that he is directly doing everything, that there's no intermediate. He thinks he is the body, and that when he moves the body, or when the body moves, that he's moving. So this is called illusion. So one who can meditate upon how this is illusion, then he can understand something about, for instance, that our present conceptions of life are false. We're covered by illusion. So much so that we're not even understanding, first of all, we don't understand who we are. We don't even have a clue in material existence what we are, what we're, our constitution is, nor do we know how the material world goes on. Although the scientists are busily trying to understand how things are going on, factually, because they reject the possibility that there's a personality behind everything, therefore they are not very advanced in their understanding. They can understand how long it takes a marble to fall down if you, you know, throw it from the, you know, from the 50th floor. They can figure out how long it takes to fall down. And if you're interested in throwing marbles down, you know, then maybe it has some value. But as far as how the sun, how the marbles, how the sun doesn't fall down, for instance, the sun, it's chaksha esha savitasa kala grahanam rajastamasta suramurte shesha teja yas yagaya brahmati samrita kala chakra govindam adi purusham tamahang vajami. So the science of Krishna consciousness deals with more important things than marbles or satellites, whatever. For instance, it might be significant about satellites. They have satellites for telecommunication, and they're very interested how long they'll stay up there. But more important than the satellite for telecommunication is the sun. Because the sun, one day, we woke up and there was no sun, we'd be in great trouble. If there was no sunlight, there was no heat, then we probably wouldn't wake up. We'd have to stay underneath our covers all, you know. Tell me when the sun comes up, I'll get up. Because the sun, full of infinite effulgence, is applying light and heat to all conditioned souls, to everyone in the universe. Everyone in the universe is relying on the heat and light from the sun. And we're confident that every day we wake up, we're more confident that the sun will get up in the morning than we will. It's not that one day we wake up and we hear, you know, over the radio that the sun slept in today, didn't get up. It had a bad day yesterday. Sun God had a fight with his wife and couldn't get up in the morning. No, exactly the sun rises every day exactly at the same time, at the expected time. And it gives off just the amount of heat and light so that we can see and that we can survive in this material world. It gives the right energy so that the food grows, we can see. So many things were dependent on the sun, and it's so exacting that at the exact moment it rises up. It's not that the sun is, you know, huge. They say the sun is millions of times bigger than this Earth planet. But at the same time, we don't find that the sun or the Earth are changing their orbits. Even if someone throws up a satellite for all their endeavor, but they know it can only stay up there for maybe 100 years or something, and then gradually it'll fall down. So how is it that the sun, full of infinite effulgence, so big, what is holding it up in the air? So according to the authority of Brahma, he says Krishna is holding it up in the air. And the scientists, they say, well, that's not possible because they can't be a Krishna. So is that very scientific? To say that there can't be a God, there must be some other explanation, although we don't know what the explanation is, but whatever you do, don't accept the explanation that is coming from God, because that will spoil everything. But the only experience we have of anything being put into an orbit is by a person or a team of scientists working on putting a satellite into the orbit and trying to figure out how to maximize its maintenance in that orbit. We never find that one day all kinds of satellites are just spinning around their orbit and someone asks, who did it? And someone says, who knows? It just kind of happened like that. There's some other law that we can't understand that just puts satellites into orbits. No, we automatically know there's persons behind it. So therefore, it's just logical to conclude that if the sun and the other planets are in their orbit, there must be a person putting them in their orbit. So this is called knowledge. Although it may disappoint us that that means that there's a God, it means I can't be God, or my brother can't be God, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera, that our whole point of coming to the material world has been frustrated. That is, we came here to become God, and now it's become obvious that there is a God. So let me forget this knowledge somehow or another, so I don't have to be disappointed, spoil my life, give up all the good things I was looking forward to. Now I have to become a servant of God because there is a God. So one who thinks like that, it's very hard for him to accept the existence of Krishna or God. But one who can understand things properly, he understands that it's very logical and consistent knowledge that there is God and that he's controlling everything. That everything in the universe is controlled by Krishna. Isha Vasha Idam Sarvam Yat Kincha Jagat Jam Jagat Tena Tena Bunjitaha Madgridaha Swasi Gridaha. Therefore, everything, both adamant and inanimate, which is within the material world, is both owned and controlled by that Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that gives certain obligations on the part of the living entity. Just like if you walk into someone's house and they own everything. You can't think, well, the guy's not home, so who cares? You know, you go into his refrigerator, you cook yourself a nice meal, and you put your feet on the couch, and you order, you know, you look into his bank account, buy yourself a few computers and a new car. And then he comes home and says, what are you doing? Who are you? What are you doing in my house? And you go, well, I didn't see you. You weren't home, so I figure it was mine. It's all mine. Get out. No, what will he do? He'll call the police, and you'll be arrested, and you're the one who'll have to get out. So similarly, although we don't see Krishna, because he's the owner of everything, we have an obligation to find out how to act properly when we come to his house, this material world. We can't be a thief, or we can't be simply irresponsible if we walk into someone's house. There are certain rules and regulations, we have certain etiquettes and certain rules we have to follow when we come into someone's house. Similarly, when we come to the material world, there are still rules of etiquette that we're supposed to follow. And if we follow them, then there's no problems. Otherwise, then we find ourselves in trouble. So here it says that Krishna has so many different energies, and through those energies, we're experiencing different things. The soul is always the same, but according to the energies that he's associating with, he has different experiences. So it is not that Krishna, he likes someone, therefore he gives them a nice experience. Or he doesn't like me, he doesn't like my face, and therefore he's torturing me. There's no other explanation. You know, how is it that God isn't giving me everything I want? There must be something wrong with him. He just doesn't like me. So why should I bother liking him? If he doesn't like me, then let him go on doing whatever he wants to do to me, and I'll just go on doing whatever I want to do too. So one has to understand that actually Krishna, he's neutral to everyone. Echamatstani Bhutani Nibandanti Dananjaya Udasinva Nadvar Asinam Asaktam Teshu Karmasu. Krishna says, I'm ever detached, seated as neutral. That although I'm doing so many things in the material world, I'm doing everything, but still I'm unattached. I'm seated as though neutral. Just like we worship the deities here, Shishi Radha Gopina. So why would we worship the deities if they're, you know, you read the newspaper, today there was a fight in Bosnia or something, and, you know, 100 people were killed. So you think, wow, this person up there, he's doing it all. He's the one who's doing it. He killed 100 people today, at least. and he's sitting there peacefully playing on a flute. What kind of person is this? Just like in Vrindavan last year, even in Vrindavan, every day Krishna would go out, and Kamsa would send some demons, literally demons, to come and kill Krishna and harass the cowherd boys, and Krishna would kill a demon every day. So similarly, even in modern day Vrindavan, there are such people. They still exist. So last year, one of them was reading a newspaper, one of these what they call gundas, who torture and harass people, and some other gundas hired these people to come up and put them away. So at least the story I was told, he was sitting there reading the newspaper and they came up, they had MK-47s. There were like five gundas with MK-47s right across the street from our temple. So everyone thought there must be some important personality coming to visit Vrindavan, and these are the bodyguards. So they walked up to this man and said, "Is your name such and so?" And he said, "Yes." And then they literally blew him away with the MK-47s. And then someone else came running up and they blew him away. And then the bodyguard, he had a bodyguard who took out his little pistol from across the street and shot it. Ping. And then they took their MK-47s, and it was hard to find him afterwards too. Figure out who was who. And then I was told they sat down and they ordered tea. Drank their tea. And then they said to everyone around there, they said, "You didn't see anything." Needless to say, tea was free for them. No one came up with a bill. And then they just got in their car and they left Vrindavan. I don't think they went to visit the holy places afterwards. So the point is that even after doing something as horrible as assassinating someone, they just very nonchalantly, they say, without much anxiety, sat down and drank tea. So similarly, here is a person. Krishna says, "Mrityu saraharastraham." He's, by his energy, everything's being destroyed. Even ourselves, we're peacefully sitting here. But our bodies are changing. We're on our way to death. Someone was maybe killed in Bosnia today, but ultimately the material energy is killing all of us. And he's sitting there playing a flute, smiling. So what kind of person is this? One may question. He's going to live forever, and he's killing everyone. And smiling as he plays his flute as he does it. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, "Don't blame it on me." Although everything is going on under my direction, still, I am neutral. Just like the judge, he goes to his court, and someone comes before them, they give him the case, and he says, "Hang the man." So it's not that he goes home at night thinking, "Oh, I did a horrible thing today, I hung someone. You know, what would my wife think?" You go, "Oh," you come home, you say, "What did you do today, John?" "Well, I hung a few people." "Get out of my house, I never want to see you again. What kind of person did I marry?" Going around hanging people. No, the judge is on, and then you find out that they're giving him a big salary for doing it. No, because he's neutral. It's not that he's hanging people because of his desire. He's doing it because of what they desire. And because of what they desire, they became responsible for their activities. And someone's being awarded by the judge $10 million. But no one, you know, after he leaves, it's not that, you know, there's a big band outside and everyone's playing, you know, "Jai the judge, Jai the judge, he's such a nice guy. He gave him $10 million. course, nowadays maybe there are some other reasons other than justice why someone gets $10 million from the judge. But theoretically, he's just doing his duty. He's reciprocating according to people's activities and their desires. He's reciprocating with their desires and activities. But he's neutral. Therefore, whether he hangs someone or he gives someone $10 million, he's in the same position. So similarly, Krishna, he's so expert that being in everyone's heart is the super soul, he awards everyone exactly what they deserve according to what they've done and what they're desiring. But he's not responsible at all. But he comes, for instance, as Krishna, and he speaks Bhagavad Gita because he wants people to understand things properly. He wants them to understand that although he's in control, that we're the ones responsible for what's going on. And that if we want to change our situation, we have to change our consciousness, our understanding of things. We have to change our desires, principally. From desiring to become God to desiring to serve God. Krishna says, don't blame me that I'm God. I couldn't help it. I've always been God. It's not my fault. I was like that. You could say I was born like that. So it's not Krishna's fault that he's God and that we can't become God. Although we can become as good as God, and in the spiritual world, being God's servant is more desirable than being God himself. That sometimes, if one is God's servant, then one has more control than God has. But here in the material world, it is not Krishna's fault that he's God, because he's the only one who can be God. Because everything comes from him. No one can ever be equal to or greater than him. But still, Krishna, he has so many energies, and one of his purposes is that whatever he has, he gives to his devotees. We find in the Krishna book that when Krishna was here 5,000 years ago, he had 16,108 palaces. And every morning he'd wake up, and he'd perform different sacrifices, he'd do different activities. And after performing these sacrifices and activities, so many people would come up and give him gifts, because he was the king. But it's not that he took all these gifts and enjoyed the gifts himself. No, first of all, he distributed them to the Brahmins, to his ministers, to his queens, to the other people who worked for him in the temple and in his palaces. And if anything was left over, then he would enjoy it himself. So similarly, Krishna has so many different energies, but one of its qualities is that he is unlimitedly renounced. So all his energies he utilizes in the service of his devotees. So if you have a friend, he's a multi-trillionaire, and he says, whatever I have, I'm going to use for you. Then you think, wow, this is quite a friend. Similarly, Krishna, he's in everyone's heart. He's willing to give everything, but according to what we ask. If you say, well, I'm a multi-trillionaire as a friend, and he goes up to you and he says, what do you want? And you go, can you give me a few fried chickpeas? And he says, what, are you crazy? I own the whole city. I can give you anything you want. No, just give me a few fried chickpeas. I say, are you sure you don't want anything else? No. Why are you getting on my case, you know? You can't supply it for me? No, I'll give you the three fried chickpeas. So similarly, in the material world, the living entity is sitting there in this machine called the material body, and Krishna is saying, what do you want? I'll give you anything you want in Bhagavad Gita. And the living entity is saying, my dear Lord, please give me birth and death. I can free you. I can give you an eternal life. Well, if you can't give me birth and death, you might as well go away. I don't want to hear from you. Just like one lady, she was walking in the forest, carrying very heavy sticks on her head. And suddenly, because of the weight of the sticks, they fell off from her head. And she cried out, oh God, help me. I'm in the forest. I'm all alone. What to do? Who will save me? So Krishna appeared because of her sincere desire and said, yes, what can I do for you? She said, "Oh, Krishna, you're so kind. Could you kindly put all these sticks back on my head? I'm in the forest all alone, and no one can help me." So Krishna says, "No problem." Picks up all the sticks and puts them back on her head and disappears. And she says, "Thank God." So similarly, the conditioned soul, he's thinking, you know, I need so many things in the material world. He's just sitting in the material, in the body, desiring so many things. And Krishna is sensing that desire, and according to what he deserves, making so many arrangements in the material world. And when things go the way the conditioned soul wants, he thinks, "Oh, God is very kind." And when they don't go the way he wants, but as a result of what he's desired in the past, just like someone may desire to shoot someone. "Oh, I hate this guy." Bang, I shot him. But one also has to, one may desire like that, and that desire may be fulfilled, but still one has to get the reaction or the consequences of what one desires. So the material world is made in such a way that it's not only based on our desire, it's based also on getting the consequences of what we desire in terms of our activities. So there's an arrangement so that we're now presently getting the reactions for our activities, what our previous desires were. That's called karma. And according to what we desire now in the present, as we're experiencing those reactions, another set of reactions will be created in the future. Maybe pious or maybe impious reactions. But the point is that one has to accept, along with one's desires, and therefore activities, one has to accept the consequences of such desires and activities. So Krishna, he's awarding these things to the conditioned soul, but he's not at all responsible. But as long as we stay in the material world desiring whether to go to the heavenly planets or to go to hell, then Krishna will make all the arrangements because he's very kind. But we never find in the Bhagavad Gita Krishna advising the living entity to go to heaven or to go to hell. He's saying it is all a waste of time. Sarva dharma parityaja mam ekam sharanam vraja. Just give it all up and surrender to me. Follow my advice. Because his advice, just like if you were lost in the jungle and some guide came along and said, "My dear sir, you're lost in the jungle. You've been here for, 30 years. There's no food in the jungle. You're starving to death. You're suffering. There's so many mosquitoes and poisonous insects and you're being attacked all the time. Just follow my advice and I'll take you out of the jungle." And you go, "Well, I don't listen to anyone. I'm independent. Get away from me. You're spoiling my life. I'm not surrendering to you. Who do you think you are? I got to follow you." So Krishna comes and says, "I can understand everything perfectly. I'm God. Follow my advice. You'll get out of this miserable place. You're a spirit soul. You're my part and parcel. You're eternal. You're not supposed to go through these repetition of births and deaths. You're not supposed to suffer in this way." And you go, "Who do you think you are telling me what to do? Get out of my life. You're spoiling my life. I'm enjoying this birth and death. And you're trying to spoil it." So here it tries to explain how Krishna actually is God and he's arranging everything. And if we want, as much as we develop the desire to understand things properly, then Krishna will help us and give us that understanding. He'll give us the right understanding and he'll help us get out of this, all these problems that we have. But if one thinks that this is not possible, the only thing that could be happening is birth and death. Or there is no birth and death. Nowadays people think, well, the scientists, we should take shelter of them. They'll help us get out of birth and death. Let us take shelter of the scientists. They'll make us completely happy forever. They understand how things are actually working. So that's compared to taking shelter. If one wants to cross an ocean, and he takes shelter of the tail of a dog, because the dog knows how to swim. But if you see a dog swimming in the ocean, you think, well, here's a guy, he knows how to swim. Let me grab his tail, he'll certainly take me across the ocean. So this is not a very sane way, a very intelligent way of crossing the ocean. That one should find an appropriate means, not the tail of a dog. Similarly, if we want to cross over the ocean of material nations, of material ignorance, then we have to find a suitable boat. And the scientists are not that suitable means to cross over the ocean of ignorance so that we can find an eternal life full of happiness. And here Krishna is explaining how he is that suitable boat, and that if we take shelter of him, then Krishna can change the energy from external energy, illusion, to internal energy, and then we can understand things properly, understand what's desirable and what's not desirable, and therefore focus our attention in the right way, focus our desires in the right way, so gradually we can cross over the ocean of ignorance and come back to our original position as Krishna's eternal servant. Or if one takes up the service of Krishna in the right mood, as expressed here, with the determination for penance, that is service to Krishna, and feeling a little sorry that we've been walking around as if we were the god since time immemorial, but actually we're just being kicked by, we're actually less than dog. We're being kicked around by the illusory energy and being proud of it. So when we feel a little sorry about it, I've been wasting my time in the material world, being kicked around by the illusory energy and feeling proud about it, feeling good about it. Just like Ravana, I was told by Bhaktivedanta Purna Maharaj that in previous ages, people were able to maintain their bodies in different ways. Just like nowadays, I saw when we were coming here, in India, of course, in India, on the streets, the way they drive, something or someone dies on the street. So I saw coming from Delhi, driving through Delhi, there was one dog completely squashed on the street. No one takes any notice. And then there was some huge pig. I couldn't believe it. It was as big as a car, practically. Half the size of a car. It was lying there, upside down. You know, it was completely, something hit, you know, a car must have hit it or something. Probably smashed the car. It was just lying there right in the middle of the street. People just like passing, you know, by the car. Or by the dead pig. Not paying any notice to it. So, similarly, in the material world, here we're in this... Actually, I forgot the analogy I was trying to make. Oh, yeah, that's right. So, he was saying that in previous ages, here if you get hit by a car, you're finished. Someone just sticks a knife into you, you're finished. But I forget exactly what it was, but for instance, in Ravana's time, which is straight to yuga, that people could maintain themselves just by breathing. Maybe that was Dwarpa Yuga. Just by, in Satyuga, I think it was just in the mind. But as long as your mind was together, you could maintain your life. Just like Hiranyakashipu maintained himself in his bones. And at least in Ravana's time, if you just maintain your breath, then everything was all right. So, when he was fighting against Indra, Airavata came up and smashed him in the stomach with one of his tusks. And his tusk went right through Ravana's body. But it didn't bother him at all. So Ravana, after the fight, I guess he defeated Indra. He had this big hole through his body. So I guess, rather than fill it up with plaster or something, he'd be embarrassed walking around, with a big hole in your body. So he filled it up with jewels. And he was proud of it. He'd show people, I guess. Sometimes, this is where Ravana got me, People come up and look through him and go, wow, that's far out. So in this age, we can't maintain ourselves in that way. Someone just sticks a little pin into us, we fall down. We're finished. So Krishna's energies are working in such a way that In order to maintain this body, we have to do so many different things. But still, Krishna is saying, simply take shelter of Krishna.
People come up and look through him and go, wow,
that's far out. So in this age, we can't maintain ourselves in that way. You know, someone just sticks a little pin into us, you know, we fall down. We're finished. So Krishna's energies are working in such a way that in order to maintain this body, we have to do so many different things. But still, Krishna is saying, simply take shelter of Krishna. And if we do that, then ultimately if we come to the highest platform, that is the penance, perform the penance of devotional service and repentance, that why am I thinking that I was such an exalted personality? Actually, I'm simply bewildered by the illusory energy, and that my only hope is to take shelter of Krishna. That everything else besides that is actually another source of bewilderment. Although I may be very proud of my achievements, but if they're all based on illusion, what is the value of them? Just like Prabhupada would sometimes say that the six Goswamis are very rich. Tyaktva purnama shesha mandalapati shenim sadatu chava bhutva dina gunesha ko karunaya Gopi nakanta shitao Gopi bhavara samrita dilahari kolola magna moho bande rupa sanatana raga yago shri jiva gopalago. So it says that the six Goswamis, they gave up everything. Tyaktva turnam ashesha mandalapati. They were the kings. They were Raghunath Das Goswami. He had servants, he had a wife which was more beautiful than the wife of the King of Heaven. He had, by the standards nowadays, he was a multimillionaire. But he gave it all up. Rupa Goswami, when he retired, he had a boat full of gold coins. And they gave them all up and they became mendicants, begging door to door. But they were actually richer because they were in the mood of the gopis of Vrindavan, constantly feeling transcendental pleasure through feelings of separation from Krishna. So Prabhupada used to say, people may think that they're very rich and wealthy, but actually they're very poor. They're rich and wealthy, but it's all an illusion. If suddenly someone comes up to you and says, I'm going to give you $100 billion, and then gives you a package with all kinds of money in it. You think, wow, now I've become rich. And then you open up the package and it's all full of monopoly money. You think, what did they do? They cheated me. I've been cheated. And you go, no, it's $1 million. It says right on there. It says pay to the bearer $1 billion. You can use it. It's all good in a monopoly. Or if at night you go to sleep and someone in your dream gives you $1 million. You think, I'm rich, he gave me $1 million. And then someone wakes you up. And you go, what did you do? I was a millionaire and you woke me up, I lost everything. It's all your fault. I was going to enjoy and you spoiled it all. So similarly, people are walking around thinking, I'm rich, I'm a billionaire, I'm this and that. But in one sense, it's all just like monopoly money. You can use it in the material world, sure, but it has nothing to do with reality. It's all a dream. But if you wake up and you find out that actually you have a chintamani, you're the possessor of a chintamani palace made out of touchstone, you don't have to pay the electric bill, it's all free. And in the Chintamani Palace, there are a couple of riksha trees that give you anything you want. Then you actually are rich. You get an eternal life full of bliss and knowledge with all facilities. You can control God, who's controlling everything. Then you're actually rich. Therefore, if one comes to do this penance and austerity, repentance that I've wasted my time here in the material world doing nothing, simply that's all I've done since time immemorial, waste my time, although sometimes I'm Brahman, sometimes I'm an ant, and I should give this up and follow Krishna out of this forest of illusion and come back to my original home and take up my real service, my real activities, then one becomes very fortunate. So something like that is explained here. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes.
But actually, glad to hear that we should lament about our past, how you have been acting as you were, as if you were God. And then, and other instructions said that, you know, if you lament, you're in the mode of ignorance, or, you know, it's an offense to be morose.
We should understand that there are different types of lamentation. There's a difference between, say, you're walking down the street and you step on someone's foot. You go, "I'm sorry." The guy goes, "What are you doing? You shouldn't lament." No, if you do something wrong, it's good to lament. Not that you walk down the street, you know, say you're driving your car, you smash into someone. And they go, "Hey, that's great, isn't it?" And the guy goes, "What do you mean? You just smashed my car." And you go, "You got to think positive. You shouldn't lament." Or you should say, "Oh, I shouldn't lament. My philosophy is think positive. Whatever I do, I should be enthusiastic about." "Well, you just smashed my car. Don't you feel sorry?" "No, man, I feel great." No, we should lament for what we do wrong. But not that we should just, you know, sit around lamenting. We should feel sorry and then we should do something about it. That's the real sign that we're actually feeling sorry. The guy goes, "Well, you just smashed my car, you know. What do you feel?" You go, "I feel sorry." "Well, what are you going to do about it?" "Nothing at all." "Because actually, I don't mind at all." "It's your car, you know, it's your problem." No, if we actually feel sorry, then we'll do something. We won't sit around just lamenting. But if we just sit around and lament, then we'll certainly be in the mode of ignorance. And if we do something about our lamentable condition, and we obtain Krishna consciousness, then we'll actually become happy. Just like Maharaj Parikshit, after he garlanded Samika Rishi with a dead snake, he started to lament that I did something wrong. And because of that lamentation, Krishna was in the heart, he purified him. But what if he would have thought, "Well, I got on that dead snake, he deserved it." You know, I should go back and kick him. Then Krishna would never have purified him. He would have become more and more entangled. Yes, Madhuri.
How is it that Krishna is all powerful but he can't help being God? It sounds like contradictory.
You mean if he wanted to, he wouldn't, he could? Well, this is why we're here, because we think it, because we have that type of understanding. You know, why should he be God? If he was really God, well, why shouldn't he be? He can make himself that he's not God. Well, he does that. In Vrindavan, he acts as a servant of his devotees. He doesn't play the role of God. He becomes the servant of his devotees. So in the spiritual world, he can not become God. You got to talk to him about it. No, he's not God. He's being controlled by Mother Jasoda. No, I mean, ultimately, he's being controlled by Mother Jasoda, by Radharani, and by others. If Radharani says that you should go back to the spiritual world, and Krishna says, "Well, I don't know. You know, I have my doubts." Radharani says, "No, forget it. You know, send her back to the spiritual world." Krishna says, "Well, what can I do? She told me to do it."
No logic that can explain that.
Ultimately, it's achintya. It's inconceivable. If it was conceivable, then how could he be God? If we could conceive of it completely, then how could he be God? So it's a chintya. So in one sense, he's so much God that he does. He's not God. But of course, he always is God. And the more you think about it, the more you become Krishna conscious. Then one day you'll realize that he is God. And then you'll realize he's really not God. That Krishna is so inconceivable that even a tiny living entity, I mean, think of how many living entities there are. There's, you know, even in this room, there's so many trillions of living entities in this room. And every one of them, when they become perfect, they can control God. Is controlling the whole universe, billions of universes. So that's quite inconceivable.
He's always expanding. Does it mean that the new source and our source is a billion, or is there a fixed amount of souls? Because we are eternal, we didn't
create us. Well, there are already an unlimited number of souls. Unlimited. Well, it's try and count the ones in this room, and then try and count the ones in the next room. It's inconceivable. I mean, this is just one little tiny universe, and there are unlimited universes. There are more universes. I mean, we'd have no idea what this universe is. Even this planet we can't even conceive of, how many living entities there are. Even on this planet. And this planet is a speck of dust in the universe with unlimited planets, and the universe is just one of the universes. It's like a grain of sand on the beach. And the whole spirit material world is just said one quarter of the creation. So you don't think there's enough souls?
I understand it. If there are a limited amount of souls and they're eternal, but unlimited doesn't mean, you know, fish or not.
Yes, it seems pretty unlimited to me. I mean, we want to make friends. There's enough people to make friends with in the spiritual world. If you go there, you won't get bored, you know. Same old people all the time. It's unlimited. It's completely, it's inconceivable. As far as Krishna's expanding his energies, he expands his energies to serve his devotees, because that's the way he enjoys. So, as far as new living entities coming into existence, they're eternal. All living entities are eternal. And there's unlimited numbers of them. How they're unlimited is beyond our comprehension. How there can be unlimited living entities. We can't conceive of it. But that's because we're trying to conceive of it within some kind of limited space. You know, here, in this material world, everything is limited. So we think in the spiritual world, everything must be limited too. Because it just doesn't fit into our existence here, our experience. You know, immediately we try and figure out in our mind, and we hear this sizzling sensation in our brain. How is this possible? It's not possible in the material world, but it's possible in the spiritual world. And how it is, I can't explain it, because it's inconceivable. Yes.
Many times people ask why we seem to be more and more humans, and what do we actually have?
I haven't noticed that. Many people say it's the opposite. Some people, why they're less and less human beings on the earth? Depends on your perspective.
Prabhupada says something about that with the appearance of Shankara, that it had a function, that there would be more and more.
Well, in one sense, there's probably not more human beings on the earth than there were in Dwarpa Yuga. He said in Dwarpa Yuga that, I forget exactly, but Krishna, he married 16,108 queens. He was just living in Dwarka, a small place. And he had, from each queen, he had 10 children. And from each of the children, they had 10 children. So that was 16,000, yeah. And then they all had thousands of servants. He said that there were so many children in the Yadu dynasty that it took 32 million tutors to tutor them. And Ugrasena had so many hundreds of billions personal bodyguards. It was 3 trillion. So, well, he was a little insecure. He felt insecure. So it's not that, actually in Kali Yuga everything has become much more limited, but we think it's increasing. But if we want to explain it, because no one's going up to the heavenly planets, because no one's performing jaga, everyone's falling down from the heavenly planets because their time's running out, and the hellish, everyone's, you know, if anything, people are falling down to the hellish planets, but there's no elevation going up, and people from down are coming up here. So we can look at it like that. But the population increase is actually not very significant. If you heard, you know, there were 100 million more ants today, you wouldn't think, wow, there's a population increase. There's so many hundreds of trillions of ants, you know, quadrillions of ants. You know, 100 million more doesn't really make a big difference. Certainly, we take ourselves so seriously. In the demigods, you know, planet, there are 32 million principal demigods. Each one of them has a planet. So they have, you know, trillions of demigod followers. So if they heard, you know, on the Earth planet, there was 100 million increase. I mean, to them, we're just like ants. They wouldn't take it very seriously. Yes?
Question about the multiple personalities. That, for example, if Tim is the allergic to peanut butter and John isn't, then, you know, Tim gets a rash or something, and John is being cured of it. Does it mean it? Does it prove that? That obviously sickness that they come from the mind.
Principally, yeah, that's what it proves. Yeah, the mind, the body works under the control of the mind. So when the mind changes, the body changes.
How does it relate to karma?
That's karma. The body works just like a machine. So not only, according to what we've done in the past, we get a certain body, but we also get a certain mind. And the mind changes. Prabhupada said, just like bubbles come up from the bottom. You know, how they come up, we don't really know. From the bottom of a lake, sometimes bubbles come up. How they're coming up, we don't know, but they're coming up. So similarly, certain desires and ideas arise within our mind, you know, from our past, according to how we've been conditioned from the past. They're stored in the mind. Past desires, and they just arise spontaneously. Of course, we can figure it out. There's an analyzation of how to figure it out, how they come up. But due to certain circumstances that have been, that come about due to our past activities, we're faced with certain circumstances. And according to how we've interacted with those energies in the past, certain feelings arise automatically. Because we have certain ideas about things, and certain feelings arise. And according to those feelings, if we become attached to them, then we become responsible for them. On the other hand, with superior knowledge, Krishna consciousness, then we don't become attached. We see things in a different way. And when we see things in a different way, we, instead of becoming attached in a material way, we can even become attached in a spiritual way, thinking how I can engage these different persons or different energies in Krishna's service. So instead of becoming bewildered and entangled by the different energies we come in contact with, we become more enlightened by them, we become more liberated. So, the one thing we can change is our consciousness. But by changing the consciousness, we change everything. Sometimes we hear that by Krishna, all you can do is become Krishna conscious, and we think, what a drag, you know. I want to become rich and famous, and I want to get, you know, I want to become healthy. But if we change the consciousness, we get everything. It's not a small thing to change the consciousness. But when one changes the consciousness, everything changes. So Prabhupada said even we were destined that there was some war. Just nowadays they talk about the war or whatever. So many astrologers talk about a war. But if we change people's consciousness, then everything will change. Just like if you walk home at night, you enter into your house, and you find someone in your house, and you think, this must be a thief. And you go up and you hit the person. And they say, well, this must be a, you know, and then they hit you back, and you hit them even harder. And finally the lights go on. You find out it was your, you know, your husband. You think, wow, if I would have known that, then, you know, why am I fighting with him? So similarly, under illusion, we're thinking, I'm American, I'm Indian, I'm Russian, I'm this and that. You know, we're fighting with each other. When we find out that actually we all come from the same family. You know, that this is all my father's property, it didn't belong to me anyhow. Then why would we fight? So by the change of consciousness, everything changes. Yes.
It seems like we kind of understand that we are not this body unless we become the two appearances, right?
Well, we can understand to some extent when we use our intelligence. So it's a gradual process. It's not that one day, you know, I walk around for 70 years in the Hare Krishna movement, you know, just thinking myself the body. And one day, you know, I just wake up, wow, I'm not this body, I'm a pure spirit soul. And gradually, a little bit, step by step, we become purified. Just like if there is a, things are covered over. I don't exactly know an analogy. What is an analogy of something, gradually wipe it away and gradually it gets clearer and clearer and clearer and it becomes completely clear? Just like in a lake. If the lake is very clear, if the lake, there's a lot of dirt stirred up in the lake, then gradually the dirt settles and then the lake becomes clearer and clearer and you can see more and more clearer what's on the bottom. So gradually as our consciousness becomes clearer, then we are able to see that actually I'm always eternal. What was so hard about that? I've been eternal, eternally. If you go to the spiritual world and say, tell the people there, you know you're all eternal? They go, no kidding, wow, you're really intelligent. So it seems a great revelation here. You know, it's just actually it's normal consciousness. But because we're bewildered since time immemorial, it seems like a great revelation. So here, people are because they pride themselves in their knowledge, although they're completely in ignorance, they don't realize what real knowledge is, which is completely simple. Here, so-called knowledge makes everything just more and more complicated, to the point we can't understand anything. But spiritual knowledge makes everything so simple that it becomes completely clear. So gradually, as we become simple, as we become purified, then it just becomes, everything becomes completely clear. Thank you very much. Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Gaur Premanande.